ANZ Voices welcomes you to the Business of Bloodstock podcast with Tim Rowe and Charmaine Bukovec.
Welcome to the third episode of the Business of Bloodstock podcast. We've got a bumper episode this week with Professor Ben Ahern from the University of Queensland, the lead researcher into endoscopy and the impact of radiography on racehorse performance, a valuable project supported by AgriFutures Australia.
Horse fitness, industry-specific online education platforms for the many, not the few. Horse fitness, doing the heavy lifting. Early bird sponsorship packages are available now. Mention ANZ Podcast for a further 5% off the package you sign up for. Align your brand with our solution. To find out more, visit www.horse.fitness.
Tim, pretty big week, as you mentioned. What have we got coming up?
Well, as I said, we just touched on Classic Sale, but doesn't stop there. We're jetting off to Auckland and New Zealand, or New Zealand and Auckland, for the Karaka Sale, which starts on Sunday. It's great to be going back. I was fortunate to go back for the two-year-old sale in November, but it's the first Karaka Sale in January that everyone's been able to get to since 2020. So I'm sure there'll be a big contingent from Australia, but also internationally Hong Kong. And there's generally a few buyers from America that like targeting that sale. So I'm sure there'll be, importantly, you know, a big international buying bench at Karaka.
I definitely think there will be. Tim, while you've been relaxing with a cocktail or a beer in a hand on a beach in Noosa somewhere, I caught up with our New Zealand correspondent, Lloyd Jackson, who took us through what he expects Karaka to be like and some of the excitement around the international buyers coming back for the first time since COVID, really.
There's not anyone that Lloyd doesn't know, so I'm sure he's on the money.
I'm very certain he is. And then in our final piece of our podcast, I catch up with Kira Fitzgerald and Amanda Miller, who basically purchased a mare a few years ago on English Digital for $1,000, put her in foal to Rich Enough. The mare's name is Jeopardy. So put her in foal to Rich Enough and sold her for $85,000 at an English Melbourne Premier yearling sale. And now, the purpose of Assurance Success is to, it's not about, you know, a million-dollar lot, but it is to talk about some of those smaller things, which, you know, that amount of money obviously can be life-changing, and really gave them a bit of extra cash in the bank to play with. So we'll hear from them and how it impacted them and how they organised that mating and a little bit more about where the foal is now.
Of course, that segment's proudly sponsored by Avesta Bloodstock. Thanks for your support again, Jimmy and Avesta.
Tim, our third podcast, and we have survived a very long Magic Millions sale.
We have. Lucky, that's why I've had to take a quick break and stay in Queensland, lovely Noosa, and saw a few racing identities and as well, so it seems to be the place to be. But come in from the beach, it's lucky to speak to Professor Ben Ahern,
yes,
University of Queensland.
You are living a life currently. And something that we obviously heard a lot up at Magic Millions was there was a lot of conjecture about, obviously, different readings on scopes and x-rays between different vets and vendors, probably a little bit bewildered and bemused when their vet has said one thing and the buyer's vet has said another. So, as you mentioned, we're joined by Professor Ben Ahern. Ben, welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be here today.
Thank you for joining us. Ben, tell us a little bit about yourself.
I'm the son of a couple of veterinarians from Southeast Queensland who were in the equine industry, subsequently went to the US for training after being a UQ graduate for vet school, went to the US and did advanced training in surgery and sports medicine, came back, worked in Sydney around the Equine Centre for 5 years, and then been back here at the University of Queensland for the last 7 years, I think. And I have a long interest and involvement in the thoroughbred racing industry and performance horses in general.
And Ben, you work closely, obviously, with AgriFutures, who have supported, I guess, the funding of the projects we're about to talk to next. But for those people who don't know what AgriFutures do or who they are formerly RIDIC. And AgriFutures not only looks after the thoroughbred horses in Australia, they look after a lot of different agricultural pursuits. So everything from bees, sheep, cattle, and obviously the one close to our hearts is horses. So where the money comes from, for those who don't know, is every mare return and every stallion, I guess, cover, $10 of that gets popped in this pool. And it's then matched by the federal government, which allows professors such as Ben to do some amazing work for the industry. So Ben, how you're obviously currently working on these two projects, the endoscopy project and the X-ray project. Tell us a little bit about these.
Yeah, so the endoscopy one is with Associate Professor Sam Franklin at Adelaide and Dr. Josie Luton, who's over in Perth. And what we've done with that is get a very large number of yearling endoscopy scopes, because quite a few horses get post-sale endoscopy. And so we've got those videos for those post-sale endoscopies, and we're going through and grading them all, utilizing a variety of grading scales, and then looked at their longer term racing performance that they've had in subsequent years. The yearling endoscopy, there's a few issues with that. They can be variable day on day, which can be some variability that's hard to control. There can be variability in different views and interpretations, which the EVA, Equine Veterinarians Association, and Brian Anderson's leading that subcommittee trying to improve veterinarian consistency. But even then, the length of the video, there's a whole bunch of variables that can come into it. But it all started way back when people were like, well, you know, we don't want to buy roarers, pretty much. We don't want to buy horses who have abnormal laryngeal function. So back in the day, a lot of horses were being presented with, well, there was an element of horses which were presented which were roarers. And prior to endoscopy, people would buy them and then they'd get them home and they'd put them into work and they would be roarers and they would be happy about that. So then post-sale endoscopy came in, which is what, you know, people have now. About five or six years ago, people started doing pre-sale endoscopy at the sales. So they'd have a bunch of vets walking around scoping horses prior to sale, and then started giving them the horses which were not fails, but lower grades were being attributed some likelihood of success or not. So in Australia, these are 1 to 5 grading scale, grade 4s and 5s fail, and 1s, 2s, 3s, post-sale are a pass. But what people were doing, now they're getting pre-sale information, and 1s, 2s, 3s, and some people were saying, well, grade 1s, that's a lower number. They've got to do better than the 1s at your grade 3s. And there's a lack of scientific evidence that that's true or not. So what Josie and Sam and my study there is trying to see whether there's any validity in trying to break down 1s, 2s, 3s, or whether that should all just be pass in yearling endoscopies. That's just a pass. And if there's no effect on their long-term performance, why are we trying to break them down further than what needs to be done? So that's what that study's trying to do, to see whether there's any validity in the concern about those lower grades. Everyone sort of agrees that grade 4s and 5s should fail, but they're picked up on post-sale scope. The furor at the moment mostly is on, you know, those 1s, 2s, 3s, which currently post-sale are a pass, but pre-sale, people are, without a whole lot of scientific evidence in a lot of cases, trying to attribute higher risk to the grade 3s than 1s and 2s, which we're looking to see whether that's true. So that's the endoscopy one. Yep.
Yep. So just touching on that. So say, for example, Ben, I was chatting to obviously a few buyers, and a buyer turned around and said, oh, we don't pass a 3 on scope. It's too risky. It's not a pass. And I said, well, technically it is a pass. So I guess, and Tim was chatting earlier today to someone about 2 ranges on that 3. Tim, do you want to maybe?
Yeah, I was speaking to someone just to try and find out, I guess, how many horses potentially fail the post-sale scope, and didn't want to give specific numbers, but he said the query comes down to there's 3A and 3B, and, you know, the Bs can go into a 4, and probably some veterinary reviews maybe quite go into a 4, where A's will, you know, improve and shouldn't impact their racing career. And I guess as you know, we spoke to that same a major stable, wasn't it, Charmaine, who said we're not buying 3s, that's where the frustration comes down to vendors.
There's 2 papers out there on this, or 2 bodies of research. One was by Ian Fulton, leads in New Zealand sale horses, and he didn't find any difference for the grade 3s versus 1s and 2s. And then there's another paper by myself and Sam Franklin and Stuart Valance and a few other people who showed a trend where your high grade 3s, in brackets, depending on what laryngeal grading system you're using, may potentially earn less money. There wasn't statistically significant, but it got pretty close. And that reflects the concern in the industry. Now, my opinion is that probably amongst grade 3s, 95% of grade 3s are perfectly fine. There may be a few at the upper end, which are these borderline grade 3s, which might be the bad apples spoiling it for all the fun grade 3s who are perfectly normal. Now, some very famous racehorses were grade 3s, right? So if you go by that rule, you may not have bought some of the best racehorses in the last decade, right? And there is a lot of evidence that most grade 3s are, well, some evidence would say that all grade 3s are fine. Most evidence would say that most of them are actually fine. Now, what we want to do with our research is funded by AgriFutures, which is amazing. Thank you for that, to AgriFutures. We want to see whether or not that's true. Because the 1s, 2s, 3s, if there's no significant difference between what grade 3s earn, then 1s, 2s, 3s should all just be pass in yearlings. The reason why the five grading scale was initially developed by a guy called Lane out of the UK. And the wording has gradually changed over the years. And the wording of that Lane scale is different than what's called the Havemeyer scale, which has more scale, more grades, more subdivisions. And as you know, if you take 10 lollies and you divide them once down the middle and you say that's the line we're going to use, most people are going to agree that that's below and that's above, right? But if you have 10 lollies and you give you 20 grades, where those lollies end up in those 20 different grades will be very different between you, Tim, and you, Charmaine, and me. So having more and more levels of differentiation, which may be good from an academic point of view, may not actually be good. It is not good from a buyer's or seller's point of view because they see all this variability. They go, where's all this variability coming from? And the variability is not necessarily the fact that the veterinarians or the horses don't change and the veterinarian's interpretation probably doesn't change. But just you've got so many categories that all of a sudden things start to get off and then people are unhappy because they're seeing variability when potentially there doesn't need to be.
There's another view put to me. If you were representing, you know, a trainer or an agent, an owner, in that, I guess, that grade 3 bracket again, that if you're buying a sprinter, you know, Magic Millions 2-year-old, they're all going to win, or the English Millennium, versus, you know, you've bought a Derby horse that needs to obviously relax and breathe. Would that come into the opinion of going, you know what, that's a higher risk as opposed to, you know, it's a pass. It shouldn't be a variable.
Yeah, it for a vast majority of them, we suspect they're probably absolutely no different. There is potential that maybe some of those high level ones are. And what Josie's research and our research is looking to do is to quantify in real time how many frames of an image that means. So all the videos are watched and they're generally 25 frames per second. You know, is 5 frames per second too much, or is 10 frames per second too much? So it takes out some of the human variability. Now, the reason behind your question is that short sprinters tend to, you know, anything up to, you know, 12, 1400 meters can be restriction, is in the what's called the anaerobic exercise potential. So you, Tim, can probably run 80% holding your breath, 80 meters holding your breath, right? So if the race was 85 meters, you probably, even if you couldn't breathe, you probably would still beat Tim too, who could breathe, right? Because there's no impact. But if you ran 200 meters holding your breath, you, Tim too, who can breathe normally, would run a hell of a lot better than Tim one, who couldn't breathe normally. So as you get out of the anaerobic exercise space, which for horses is about 800 to 1,000 meters, which is why roarers can trial fine. They do really well. It's not until you get out further distances that the effect starts to compound. So that's the basis behind your observation. But, you know, as a, if the horse is mostly racing 2 or 3 year old, a vast majority, if not all, grade threes probably will be fine. The longer you go, the longer the race, and the more progressive or severe is the respiratory compromise, is the poorer your horse will do.
So, Ben, that is so insightful to begin with, because obviously a lot of people discuss it and they might not have the science behind what's happening. But as a breeder, and I think, you know, it's great to be a buyer and go, yeah, we're just going to write this off. And you mentioned some really famous racehorses were grade threes. I don't know if you have any of them to hand, any of those big names, or if you can share them.
I do, but I'm not telling you.
we'll have to guess maybe. But look, I think, sure, you know, that's a really interesting way of putting that. But as a breeder, you know, breeding a horse to get to, or a sale ring to begin with, or to the track, is not an easy feat. I know the perception out there is that it's, by some, that it's easy, you know, breeders are making a heap of money, but you bring your horse to sale, you think you've got a great horse, the scope comes in at 3, you have a buyer that goes, I'm not accepting that. But then you could have a vet, and you mentioned the word consistency. You could have one vet who says it's a 3, another who says it's a 2, and you've got all the vets in the repository debating it. So I guess, and I know your focus is a research study and whether or not it impacts performance on the track, but is there a piece of work there to educate buyers and veterinarians who are reading the scopes about what, you know, obviously vets do an enormous amount of study and I don't want to take that away, but going, this is the interpretation, or trying to, I guess, make it a little bit more consistent.
So unpicking that a little bit more, Charmaine, because that's a big bundle of things you've got there. It's not a simple question. So a lot of people breed their horse, they get it scoped on the farm prior to going to the sale, right? And they go, the veterinarian scopes it often with a fibroscope, you know, and goes, oh, you know, it's a grade 1, it's a grade 2. They give it some grade based on what their assessment is. Now, a lot of the bigger studs will get video endoscopic examinations done, which can be recorded, and then it's paid in their nice little venue. You can go and watch the video. So that grade is on one examination on one day. And then the horse is subsequently presented at the sales, and you get a whole, again, another veterinarian who is now working for this, for the buyer, who will come and scope it, and they scope it again at the sales in the box probably, and they say, well, I think it's a grade 3 instead of a grade 2. Now, but they only report that to the buyer, and then you have buyers and sellers arguments, and it all gets quite confusing. And then you've got the post-sale scopes, which are videos, which are viewed by one person, but that's only whether it's a pass-fail, right? So the post-sale scopes don't generally get ascribed a grade. You're talking all about pre-sale stuff here. Now, the pre-sale stuff, the point is that they're on different days, those examinations, so there's some variation day on day between what the horse's laryngeal function can be. Some of those images will be recorded, some of them won't be recorded, some of them will be long, some of them will be short, some of them will have 3 swallows, some of them will not. And because of that, it can make it very hard for veterinarians to necessarily agree on what it was. Now, this is acknowledged by veterinarians, like the EVA, the Equine Veterinarians Association of Australia, has a subcommittee specifically trying to improve this. Now, the first thing is you need to improve the quality of, or the consistency of, the exam which is done. So doing it, you know, in a stable, out in the sun, without a video, and then ascribing it a grade, you're going to get more variability between people. It's just going to happen, right? Not the horse might be exactly the same. That's the first thing. The horse might be exactly the same, but people are going to see different images down the scope, okay? So if you're going to go on a grade, it needs a consistent exam, which the EVA has defined, and need to be using the same grading scale, which is the first thing, and you need to agree what the differences are between those horses and those different grading scales. Now, the lane system has arguably some vagueness between some of the grades, which, depending on your interpretation, you can horses can go up or down slightly. So, long-winded answer to your horses can be different day on day. So exams on different days can be a grade or two different. There's heaps of research to prove that. And then, you know, if it's not recorded and it's not played back and it's not long enough quality, then it's hard to, you know, shoot the vets for, not that I'm saying shoot the vets, that was the term of phrase, but you've got to get some consistency there. And a week or a month later, the horse's grade could be slightly different. But the EVA is working on that, to answer your question. And our study, our results, will probably likely help the EVA talk to the selling agents and to the sales rings to try and justify some improvements. So, like, things like, you know, maybe the post-sale scope should go away and they should all be pre-scoped prior to the sale. Like, if the horses just turned up and everyone was scoped and they were all ascribed a grade by a panel of three people, you know, that would potentially solve some of the issue. But none of that has been worked out.
The other one that we have had a bit of conjecture about that I think has been going on for some time is x-rays.
Mm. Yeah, so x-rays, so another hats off agri-features there. Just the last plug about the endoscopy one. Our research group has actually got some buyers and seller groups and also veterinarian groups who are being participating in online discussion group about what some of the issues are. Just so that our research is aligned with industry concerns. So if anyone's interested, they can email out to Sam or myself or Josie. But yeah, talking about radiology is, you know, a lot of the issues are the same in endoscopy for radiology, except radiology is a bit more established and has been around for a bit longer. Radiology, if you think about it, the images are acquired on the farm and they are submitted, and then there's a bunch of veterinarians sitting around in a room looking at computer screens who are reviewing the images, and then they're ascribing some risk, low, moderate, high. Again, you start to talk about what grading scale different people are using, but say roughly low, moderate, high, and then they ascribe some longer term consequence to those lesions, to the horse's long-term racing success. Now, the thing is that some lesions are pretty uncommon, and also there's a lack generally of large longitudinal studies, as in research which have looked at, you know, 100 horses or 1,000 horses with that lesion versus 1,000 horses without that lesion, and did that lesion make any difference on its long-term success. A lot of veterinarians who are looking at it often have to rely on personal experience, which is very high in some people's opinion, other people's is less high. But your personal experience might be on a handful of horses which had that particular type of lesion. And as a result, I might have had 4 or 5 lesions with that type of lesion. They all you know, didn't run out of sight in a dark night. So hence I would ascribe a high significance to that radiographic lesion. Whereas veterinarian X next to me might have had three of those five lesions win the Melbourne Cup. And as a result, they might say that that lesion's a really good lesion to have. The fact is that the lesion, the incidence of these lesions is generally not really high. Like if you look at 1,000 yearlings, the incidence of lesions is like 2 to 3% of horses will have a radiographically evident lesion. Now, that number of lesions, some of those lesions will mean absolutely nothing to those horses. And in other horses, it might be very significant. I mean, back in the day, stifle cysts were all, everyone suddenly became very concerned with stifle cysts. So all stifle cysts got, you know, ascribed a high risk and no one would touch them in a 10-foot pole. But then some very smart person went around and went, well, hang on a second. You know, 2/3 of these stifle cysts actually run really well. So they went around and bought all of the stifle cysts. Any stifle, that was a criteria, was to buy horses with stifle cysts. And they worked on 1/3 of them would have problems they couldn't manage and 2/3 of them would be perfectly fine. And I know for a fact that those people went around and got a lot of very good horses for very cheap because they didn't, they just didn't ascribe all stifle cysts the same risk gradient. Now, the problem with stifle cysts, they're reliably unreliable. And generally, when they go become a problem, they can become a problem you can't pick. So that's the other thing to remember. There's a whole bunch of radiographic changes which we can manage. And veterinarians manage all the time. And those horses go in a race really well. So hence our agri-futures supported study is looking at, I think, about 8,500 yearlings and their radiographic. This is digital radiograph, so post the old films, the old plain films and things. The digital radiographs, the high quality radiographs, and we've got their 4 to 5 years of racing performance after their sale, and we're looking to see whether it has, you know, what lesions have an effect on those racing success of those horses. So that's the study there. And hopefully what they will do is your veterinarian will be in their repository and they'll go, oh, look, here's a lesion X of the fetlock. And they'll go, oh, right. Well, Brody Argue, who's the veterinarian who's one of my residents who's leading this research, his paper, they pull out his paper or they'll do a sequence of them and go, oh, well, Brody found 100 of those lesions and 99 of those horses went on with no significant difference in racing duration, starts as 2-year-old, 3-year-old, 4-year-old, dollars earned, or quality class races or lesion Y did. And so someone who doesn't have, well, no one has 8,500 sets of radiograph experience on the same way that this research is doing. And hopefully that will allow people to make more informed decisions about the potential long-term racing effect of a certain radiographic change.
And Ben, how far away are you from releasing these findings, or are there any preliminary findings so far that you've discovered?
We're just doing a statistical analysis now, which, as you can imagine, is a big data set. As the 2 to 3% of thoroughbred racehorses presented high quality yearly sales had lesions. And there's some interesting findings in there related to certain types of lesions, but we probably will present it at Bain Fallon, which is the EVA conference for veterinarians. This year's already pretty much gone, the year after, and it'll be published before then. So everyone will, we're publishing an open access journal, so anyone can Google them and find them, whereas publishing closed access requires you to be a registered member of Stead College. So AgriFutures is paying to open access so everyone can have access to it. And I'm sure Annalise McGraw at AgriFutures will have me standing up somewhere telling everyone about it. I think I'm actually doing that in Melbourne next week.
Yes, I was going to say, I believe Annalise has got you at the Ngambi Brewery on, I've got here the 1st of February from 6:30 to 9 p.m. So if you are in Melbourne at that time and you want to hear about what we've discussed a bit more today, you can email tasman.ro@agrifutures.com.au. We don't believe there's any relation to our loved Tim Rowe there, but there's a whole lot of information that I'm sure AgriFutures will push out over time as well.
And that's not me or me from 6:30 to 9 o'clock, just in case people don't want to hear about it for that long. I'm sure there'll be other really good presentations in there as well. I'm a small part of it.
The other thing I was going to ask you, Ben, is obviously mm-hmm. they've got the event on the 1st of Feb, but if you can't make it, where can people go to find out some more information about these two projects?
So AgriFutures publishes a report on it every year, which I'm pretty sure that's publicly accessible. AgriFutures also... has us go around to a bunch of breeding and different forums to present it, which is really good. It will also be published in a peer-reviewed journal somewhere, probably an open access journal like Animals or Frontiers. As I said, you can easily do a Google search for a person's name or the topic, and the word of warning is that there can be a lot of noise in the Google search. So a website such as PubMed.com has just scientific journals. So PubMed's a really good place for people to search. Or reach out to whoever your local interested veterinarian is or specialist, and they'll be able to tell you what's going on in the industry. The industry's at that level, it's not that big. Everyone knows, everyone else is doing this in the world.
Well, Ben, you are doing some amazing work for the industry, and I have no doubt, I'm very much interested in this side, so I will be reading the abstract anyway when it comes out, but at the very least. But Ben, I think we might get you back on once you've released the projects so we can update both vendors and buyers on the complete findings.
Sounds good, Charmaine, and thanks for your time, and nice to meet you, Tim.
I'm about to be joined by Lloyd Jackson, our New Zealand correspondent, on the eve of the New Zealand Bloodstock Karaka Yearling Sale. Lloyd is going to take us through a little bit about what's been happening and what we should expect. Lloyd, how are you today?
I'm as well as I can be. In fact, life is very good and I'm having a great time. Thank you very much.
Lloyd, that's a very good way to be. Now, we're all on the verge of arriving at the sale. Tell us so far, what's the word ahead of the New Zealand Bloodstock Sale?
I've had my spies out and I've watched a little bit of some interviews. We have a local racing program here called Weigh In, and they interviewed Andrew Seabrook from New Zealand Bloodstock. And he'd not long returned from the Magic Millions sale. And he said that the interest level in our sale here at Karaka is unbelievable. The hotel that they've got on the ground, they could have sold that four times over. And so the interest is very high. Australian trainers, Australian agents, they're all going to be there. So. That's official. That was like a public announcement. Last Thursday, I was over at a yearling parade of Little Avondale Stud in Masterton. And that's Sam and Katrina Williams. And Sam had also been to the Gold Coast. And he was telling me that the interest again is just amazing. So consequently, they went up, they took their draft up on Sunday. And they're already there, and they're just he just feels that he needed to be there early because he was expecting a lot of activity. And then earlier today, I sent a little note off to the some of the marketing people at NZB, just giving them a heads up that ANZ was going to be there, and that we've got some hard copies being produced from Thursday onwards. And I was just letting them know that, you know, that the three of us are going to be there, Alex, Tim and myself. And the feedback even from one of the marketing people, lovely young lady called Emma Thompson, she said the place is already teeming. So it does look pretty good.
Well, that is good. I yes, in addition to the three, our three journalists that'll be on the ground, I'll be there too, and I'm really looking forward to it. I've heard some really good things, and it seems like it will be a good sale. Now, Lloyd, talking about the graduate success, particularly of their horses, of the New Zealand bred horses in Oz, it's been absolutely phenomenal over the last year. Tell us a bit about that.
2022 has been remarkable, you're quite right. Taking horses like Rockin' Horse, you know, who won the Newmarket in March and also won the Champion Sprint in November, the likes of I'm Thunderstruck, who's just a fabulous miler, another very good horse called Mr. Brightside, who won the Doncaster, and the other one would be the horse with the wonky leg, I Wish I Win, who was never offered for sale because he had this weirdly shaped near four, and he's gone on and he won the Golden Eagle, the $10 million race. So yes, we've had some outstanding results, and the ratio of runners to Group 1 winners is we've got 1 in 14 horses in the country that are New Zealand breds, but better than 1 in 5 of the Group 1 races fell to New Zealand breeds.
There's some amazing stats there. And I think, as we just discussed, you look on the racetrack and the success is quite evident. So it is very exciting. Lloyd, you mentioned, obviously, the ground are teeming already. For the first time in 3 years, really, overseas buyers will be back. In your conversations, have you heard much about what the expectation is around overseas buyers?
Well, we got a bit of a clue back in November with the Ready to Run sale, because that sale also allowed people in. And Tim Rowe will tell you that he saw more Australian trainers there at the Ready to Run sale than there were at the, you know, the comparative sales in Australia. The activity was enormous. And I remember the first day that I got to the Ready to Run sale back in November, I just got onto the grounds, and the first person I ran into was a guy called Shane Crawford. And he runs a little place called Regal Farm, sold a very high priced 2-year-old. Anyway, he's the first person I spoke to, but his first words out of his mouth were, "The Australians are here." So, you know, everybody was G'd up and excited that the Australians were back. Well, this is going to be the same thing, but only greater, I think. That's the way it looks.
Yes, I think it is going to be very exciting. I know at Magic Man, speaking to a lot of different people on whether or not they were going to Karaka, they were saying they were mostly definitely going to be there. And I know there's a lot of Australians that have already headed across. So, yes. No doubt we'll catch up with everyone that we didn't get to catch up just on along the way. Yes. Lloyd, in your opinion, who are the sires we should look out for at Karaka?
Well, this is all very fresh in my mind because I've just written the preview and it's based on sires. And it would be remiss of me not to mention the grand old man, Savaville. He has been the glue that has held the industry together over the last few years. And one of the interesting stats that I decided to research that I put into my preview is that back in 2018, I looked at the catalogue from that year. So that's just 5 years ago. And at that point, Savaville had sired 67 individual stakes winners. Now wow. Now we're at 2023, the total is 129. Now that means he's sired 62 stakes winners, new stakes winners in 5 years. You work that out, that's 12 new stakes winners every year. That's incredible.
It certainly is, Lloyd. It's very incredible.
So he's the grand old man, and he's still doing the job, and he's a force to be reckoned with. He sits at the top of the Australian sire listings, which is not easy to do when you're not based in Australia. So he's been fantastic for our industry. But fortunately, this year we've got some support, and we've got some support in some real up and coming young sires that are making a real noise for themselves. And one of them, of course, is Perrin Canto. You know, he had an enormous year with, of course, Rock and Horse and Lost and Running. And he's got all those good horses up in Hong Kong. He's been the leading sire in Hong Kong the last 2 years based on total number of winners. So he's done extraordinarily well. Shocking had a good year, even though he doesn't have many in the sale. And then you've got the young guns like Turn Me Loose. Windsor Park have gone through a bit of a quiet spell over the last few years, but Turn Me Loose is really on the verge of, you know, making a lots of noise. And so is Westbury's Tarzino. He's already started off with a hiss and a roar. So there's some really good support right there and behind Savabeel. So I think not only the Savabeels, but I think the overseas buyers have got plenty else to look at as well.
Well, it seems like there is going to be a lot to come out of the sale, and a lot for buyers to get their, I'm not going to say teeth stuck into, but their boots on the ground and having a look at some really nice horses. So, Lloyd, thank you so much for your time and for your preview ahead of the sale. Oh,
no, you're very welcome. I'm looking forward to the sale. I think it's as good a catalogue as we've seen, and especially the sire strength. So I think NZB have every reason to be quite confident that they're going to have a pretty good sale.
So, Lloyd, I'm looking forward to catching up with you later on this week, and all the best for the rest of it.
Well, thank you. I'm looking forward to showing you and Alex around. It's a great complex. You'll enjoy it.
A share in success, shining a spotlight on ownership success stories with Avesta Bloodstock.
For our share in success segment this week, sponsored by Avesta Bloodstock, I'm joined by Kira Fitzgerald of Peppercorn Lodge to talk about her share in success. Kira, thank you for joining me.
Great to be here. Exciting to share my little story.
Yes, Kira, I have known you for what feels like forever. It's going to be at least 8 years, I think.
Yeah, I just found out the other day. So I started at Racing Victoria in 2014, I think. Is that right?
Oh, my gosh, that's insane. Yeah, I think it might be 2014 or 15.
Anyway, we were a week apart, weren't we? We started all the same week. Yeah.
Yes. So Kira and I met when we both worked at Racing Victoria, albeit in different departments, but we did our induction, I guess, together. So we used to spend our lunch breaks when we had them at the same time talking about horses and pedigree theories, and here we are now. But Kira, you and your better half Amanda Miller had a fantastic share in success a few years ago, and it all started with a purchase on English Digital when you bought a mare called Jeopardy.
Yeah, it did. It was, so now we're back to 2018, actually. So a little bit of backstory is I just recently come out of a long-term relationship. And all the finances were finally split and independent again. And the first thing I did with my first independent paycheck was buy a broodmare online.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. I don't know whether it was responsible or not, but, that's what I did. So went through the sales. I used to go through the sales all the time and track them and just, see what was going on, and always thought I could see opportunities, but obviously wasn't in the position to pursue them. And then this sale came up and I landed on Jeopardy. I think I had a couple of others that I was following that just went too high. And loved Longborough mares. At that point, his stats were, they were good, but he was quite young as a broodmare sire. But I felt that they were going to improve. And so, absolutely loved him as a broodmare sire. and loved at that point that all of her runners had been winners. One of them had placed in listed company. There was no world beaters, but they were all really solid, consistent racehorses that had all had quite a bit of longevity in their careers. Two of them had won over the $100,000 prize mark, which I liked. So I thought, and they were out of Queensland stallions that were probably probably second tier stallions. So I thought perhaps breeding her to a slightly better stallion might give her a good opportunity. She'd sort of proven herself as a producer. And I think it was, I thought, we'll see what we can produce out of her.
Well, what a bit of a sliding door moment, a little bit of a present to yourself with all that money. But yeah. Let's just take it back a little bit further. How did you, obviously you're a young person in the industry. How did you start, I guess, in the industry? Where did the love of breeding come from?
Youngish, but I'll take young, thank you. So I grew up in Queensland, actually, in went to school and everything in Toowoomba, the Darling Downs. So my parents, they both worked full time. They were, they didn't come from money, and they didn't come from the breeding or racing world themselves, but somehow fell into it. Ended up, it was actually my dad when he was young, ended up working on a horse stud, and he'd never handled a horse before in his life. And from that point onwards, I think horses and the industry was kind of in his blood and their blood. And they spent their life sort of breeding small numbers. They bred two to three. Originally it was just one a year, and then it kind of, by the end, it was up to about two or three a year that we'd breed.
Mm-hmm.
And we would grow them out and sell them at the Magic Millions January sale every year. So that's kind of what I grew up from. When I was little, I rode ponies and all that sort of stuff, but we kind of, my brothers grew out of that, and then we ended up just with thoroughbreds and breeding stock mainly. And I spent a lot of time with my dad, trailing him around the farm, asking a million questions and wanting to do this and wanting to do that. And as I slowly grew up, obviously I was allowed to do more and help more. And by the end, it was it was a bit of a team, him and I doing it all, and absolutely loved it. There was nothing that I sort of loved more than that time with the horses and all that work. And I originally moved to Melbourne when I finished my university. My parents had sort of, they'd separated and sold up the farm, and so that had all sort of come to an end with them. So when I finished my university, I moved to Melbourne and got a job in the city as a psychologist, and happily plugged away doing that for a few years, but always missed the industry and was always sort of always following it and always invested in it as much as I could in different ways. And then my job came up at Racing Victoria, which was kind of my two worlds combining, which was incredibly exciting just to get back towards the industry a bit more. And then, yeah, it was kind of, like I said, it was this relationship, the end of that, and money in the bank. It was mine, my own discretion to waste however I saw fit. And
there's nothing better when you can go, do you know what? I'm going to go buy a mare today off English Digital and I don't have to be told no. So two worlds combined, Jeopardy's purchased. She arrived, you're based in Motowari. So she arrives there.
Well, at the time, actually, this probably makes it even crazier. We weren't living on land yet. So at that point, I hadn't met Amanda. And so I was good friends with Charlotte Littlefield out at Narnagoon. So I used to go out there every Saturday and potter around and help marginally with the horses and talk a lot. So I struck a deal with Charlotte. She was amazing to me and gave me an amazing rate to have Jeopardy land at her place and be in one of her paddocks. So that made the whole thing doable for me. And yeah, it kind of rolled on from there.
So Jeopardy was then put in foal to Richener. Tell us about how you came, I guess, to that meeting.
So I was actually really keen to get involved with Cable Bay because Rick Jamieson was doing all the matings. So I actually had her checked for Cable Bay, and she was a 2 out of 3 star. So 3 star being the best, 1 sort of being a pass, and 2 somewhere in the middle, obviously. So originally that was sort of the plan with her. And then when it came and I'd working with the stud, I'd worked out a really good deal, really good price to Cable Bay that I was happy with. And then it came round to her being ready to be covered. And Cable Bay was actually out of service for a week. He'd, I can't remember if he'd injured himself or what had happened. And so I was talking to the stud and they said, look, you can either wait and miss this cycle or you can use Rich Enough for the same price. And I'd always loved Rich Enough. Like, there was just something about him that I'd always been drawn to. Wasn't the reason I brought Jet, but I loved him as a stallion and thought he was going to be a real good chance. And her previous foal, she'd had a year off in between, but her previous foal had actually been a colt by Rich Enough that had been bred by Steve Morley from Glen Logan Park because they stood Rich Enough for a season up there. So I actually rung Steve Morley and he was so, so generous with his time and his wealth of knowledge and information. And we had a really good chat about different things. And something that stuck with me and probably always will is his love of the colonial stallion and the success that obviously he's had breeding to colonial stallions in Australia. So he was a big push for Rich Enough. And also he sent me photos, update photos of the weanling colt that they had out of Jeopardy that was the Rich Enough colt, and he was absolute belter. He looked terrific. So sort of when you've got that opportunity, you got him at a great price because I got him at the price I'd negotiated for Cable Bay. And then the big pushes from Steve Morley, who has a world of experience and is hugely successful in breeding top class horses as well as making good money at the sales. I chose to go that way and took it a stud. Actually went out to Charlotte's and in Charlotte's vehicle and Charlotte's float, trundled off to stud and yeah, had her covered. I can't even remember how many times. Might have been a couple of times she had to be covered from memory. And eventually, yeah, ended up in foal. And that was all very exciting. And about 2 months into the pregnancy, mm-hmm. she actually ended up with a really bad hoof injury. She nearly sliced her hoof off, basically. And she ended up in the stable being treated and cared for again. Charlotte was incredible what she did and how she got her through. They were worried at different times that she wouldn't make it. And it was her care that really made the difference, I think.
I do remember the photos of this, and Charlotte did an exceptional job patching her up and getting her back to full health, really.
Oh, incredible job. Like, very, very gnarly injury, yeah.
Yes.
And so while she's early pregnant, she's obviously on painkillers every day and she's on antibiotics at different stages and she's having to be in a stable for... oh, I can't even remember, 3 or 4 months or something she had to be stabled for. And she's a big girl. She's a big mare. I think another thing that really got her through was she's an eater. No matter what, she's an eater. So she never went off a feed and she never sort of stopped eating. But we talked about it and we thought there was probably a pretty fair chance that she'd slip the foal, just considering everything she'd gone through. And the conditions having to live stabled like that permanently, just because, you know, if you took her out to exercise, she'd get too excited and, you know, hop around, jump around and put too much pressure and weight on that hoof. So we couldn't, it was so limited what we could do with her for a long time. But to everyone's amazement, at the end of it, she was, when I say at the end of it, it was still healing and healing, but as she got into paddocks and then she got into, you know, slightly bigger paddocks and all the rest of it, she was still in foal. So late in her pregnancy, we actually ended up finding the property we're on now, Amanda and I, and we moved in here and got Jeopardy transported over, and this is over in Motowari near past Geelong. So, yeah, Jeopardy. And at the same time, we brought another mare at the sales, so it was company for her. And, we had 130 acres and two broodmares.
And so the story begins. And so Jeopardy Fold of Philly, as you, I think, as we covered on earlier.
Yes. Yeah. So we folded down at home, and a chestnut filly. She wasn't that big. She wasn't small, but she wasn't big. She's very tidy. She's a bit down on her bumpers, but she had nice straight legs, and she had beautiful bodied little things. She always had this little muscly bubble butt and little muscles here and there and everywhere. So always a really nice little filly. But as she grew, she just, she was always a stunner. And I was always quite somewhat excited about her, just because I knew we had a really nice type, a really racy looking filly that just looked a pure athlete. And yeah, moving forward, we was pretty excited.
Yes, I do remember the every time I come out, how excited you get, all the constant updates. And I think she made it into a foal gallery or two. You were very very much in love with her.
Yes, she would have.
So we end up at the sale. She goes through Rosemont's draft at Melbourne Premier.
Yes. So we did most of the prep here ourselves, but we were worried about missing the days where Inglis and other buyers come out by the busload and come and look at them on farm and all that sort of stuff, which obviously they're not going to come here for one horse. So we spoke to Anthony Mithen. At this stage, we'd met him a while back and we'd sort of struck up a friendship. He regularly has lunch at our local shop. So him and I hit up the local shop every now and then and talk, basically, what I do with everyone that's into horses. So basically asked him if he could take her on in their draft for the sale and the sort of the pre-parades at the farm. And he somewhat reluctantly agreed. They didn't really, that's not really what they do. And I don't think they do it at all anymore, probably because of her, and she was a bit naughty. So she went from being a sort of, we actually had another filly here on adjustment with her. But she'd always been on a small farm just with pretty much one other horse and a gelding minder. So she went from our little farm where it's pretty isolated and pretty sheltered and ended up at Rosemont, where she had to go on the walker and she had to, you know, just part of the big system and all the big world stuff. And she had plenty of meltdowns. And Karen, who works at Rosemont, was phenomenal at getting her through all her issues. And she was a bit of a sensitive filly too, so she was quite reactive to things. So I'm pretty sure they had quite a few negotiations, her and Karen, and they eventually got her going on everything, got her on the walker and got her here and got her there. And she lost quite a bit of condition initially. Obviously she went there and stressed and changed her feed and all the rest of it. But got to sale and was looking very racy, very athletic, and was mostly well behaved at the sales. We still had some issues, but she was coming along really well.
She looked outstanding at the sales. I still remember her where she was at Rosemont, and I'm sure that I don't think the filly is the reason why Mitho might not do that, but you are very persuasive when you want to achieve something, Kira. So so on the day of sale, you had a little support crew there. How were you feeling on the morning of the sale before she went through?
I was somewhat positive. You get a printout, so Rosemont every day would send you a list, and they track everyone that obviously comes and inspects. So you'd look at the inspection list every day, and if someone would look at more than once, obviously you'd get a little bit excited that they might be on as a buyer. And also your x-ray hits. Now I can't remember how many x-ray hits she had. But it wasn't, neither was a huge amount. There'd only been a handful that had looked at her twice, and there'd only been a handful of x-ray hits. So I thought, it's not as many as I would ideally like. And sort of going into the ring, we were kind of in the position we were always going to sell. We weren't in the position to take her home and be able to afford to break her in and keep her or do anything like that, despite, you know, loving her and knowing she's got a bit of quality to her. So we sort of had always said the reserve would be 30, knowing that that was way under of what she should be worth. And fortunately, she went up in that ring and she went well. We didn't have to stress or worry about going home at a low figure.
No, so you and Amanda were both up in the box with Mytho, or was Mytho? I can't remember if he was
Ryan.
In the box.
Mytho
Ryan,
was at the table.
That's right. Yep, I do remember that now. Gosh, it feels like forever. And there was a group of us watching, including your mother, Amanda's parents, and some friends that were there. I actually remember gripping your mother's hand and probably taking some skin off almost. I think we're all that nervous for you. And the price kept climbing and climbing and climbing, and she achieved $85,000.
Yeah, unreal. It was so exciting. We were in the box and she started at 10, and like they always are, they're a bit slow to get going. So you're standing there in the box and you're like, oh God. And then she got going and she kicked off, and like you said, it climbed, climbed, climbed. And there was a little period there where it went bang, 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 pretty much up to that 85. And we were just standing in the box with Ryan, grinning ear to ear. We were so excited, so relieved. You're so relieved as well that all your sort of hard work has paid off, and you know, you've got an amazing result, and so relieved that she was. I think that, yeah, she got what you feel she was worth. I think it's always hard on breeders. I always try to be conservative, very conservative in values and expectations. In that way, hopefully you're not disappointed. So when you go in conservative, it's always really nice to be rewarded. And the support crew was incredible. It was so exciting having everyone there. Amanda's not from a horse background, like, so she's pretty much come into it and learned everything since we've been together, basically, and since we've been here. And it was super exciting. It was having her parents there. I think it kind of blew their mind a bit. They'd never seen anything like the horse sales, full stop, let alone us and our little foal that we'd growing in our paddock to put her in a ring and sell her for $85,000. And my mum, obviously, having done it, having bred all those sort of decades, her and dad and the farm knew how hard it was and knew how many things can go wrong, how challenging it is, how hard it is to get right, how hard it is to get those sort of successes in the ring. So she knew, obviously, how big a moment it was, and just an amazing group to have you there. I remember the whole time you were so supportive and so excited for us and always sort of championing, you know, our cause. And yeah, it was amazing to have so many people there that were so invested in us and our success, I guess, and Mytho and his crew as well. They were massive supporters. And after the auction, actually, we went out and Ryan McAvoy, who works at Rosemont, he was smiling ear to ear. He was stoked. And we got grabbed by, I can't remember who grabbed us, but we got taken to the Inglis tent where they were doing interviews.
Yes.
And yep. Had an interview with Richo.
Yep.
And it was just a whirlwind. It really was.
And Mark as well from Inglis, he was obviously CEO at the time. He brought out a big bottle of champagne, and there's a great photo of you girls beaming ear to ear either side of him.
Yes, yep, the whole group, the whole support crew and him and a bottle of champagne. It's a pretty good day, isn't it, in that very, 85 grand.
Yeah, 85K and a bottle of champagne. Where can you go wrong, Kira?
Exactly.
But it is exciting because I guess to and this is the whole point of this segment is, you know, obviously you've outlaid, you know, a bit of money along the way, but it wasn't something that you went and purchased a $300,000 mare or anything like that. It was really two people off their own back, obviously you initially, and then Amanda supported you through that, trying to get a great result. And I think for everyone who is a breeder out there or knows the process, it's a long process, and getting them to sale is a massive achievement on its own. And then to realize that $85,000 from you know, it was really your own only foal at that point. It's huge. So how did that change life for both of you at the time?
It just eased the pressure. I think that's the thing about small breeders. Often we've got ourselves under a bit of financial pressure, I guess. What did we do? We brought a new secondhand car, and we brought a new secondhand float. So we had gone from, we had a few more broodmares by then, also cheap purchases. And we were breeding, and we were having to I must have rung probably about 15 different transport people just to try and get mares to stud. It was a nightmare. It was awful. It was stressful. And buying that horse float and having the car that could tow it, it sounds silly, but yeah, it's actually a little bit life-changing, and just really cool to walk out there and see that, and it's kind of ours, and that was done by that, you know.
Well, it is crucial. I know, again, as you mentioned, small breeders, the ability to transport your own mares when you want to and need to and takes that stress out of things, that's big. You know, I know we take those little things for granted sometimes, but when it can make your life easier when both you and Amanda work full-time roles as well, you're looking after the farm and now your beautiful daughter, that is something obviously that takes a lot of stress out of things.
100%. Yep, nailed it.
So, Kira, what advice would you have to someone who is looking to get involved in horses, not sure where to start, and hears this segment and goes, oh, maybe I can do that, but where do I begin?
I think talk to as many people as you can. Track the market. Follow every sale. Follow what prices things are getting. Try and understand why they're getting it. Look who's buying. Look at the success of the people that are buying. People that are doing well, like I said at the start, Steve Morley is someone that's hugely successful. He breeds really good horses. He has a really high rate of breeding black type horses. And he also has really good success in the sale ring. So whoever it is, find someone that's doing it really well, and probably try to learn as much as you can off them. And if you can find someone that will guide you, which there are lots of people out there, you know, myself included, anybody that's interested and anybody that wants to talk and learn, I love talking to and sharing everything I can with them. And you always learn back from them in return, because everybody has a different view on things and a different take on things, and sometimes you learn new things from people that are new to the industry as well, just a fresh perspective. So talk to as many people as you can, spend as much time as you can reading and studying, reading articles, talking to people, following the sales and tracking horses. I think don't rush in, but when you're ready, go for it.
I think that's very good advice. And I think, as you said, there are so many people who are happy to teach those coming up into the industry. So I think it is crucial utilising those resources, because you can still read your articles, and a horse can defy that rule or will be the exception. So, yes. Well, Kira, thank you for joining us. I've loved hearing your story again, even years later. And actually, one thing we didn't cover is she's now racing as well, the filly.
She's just started this year. Yeah, so she's had two race starts this year. Her first was at Cranbourne, and she came a third behind that really good filly, Benedita?
Yeah.
Who thrashed them all, won by about 5 lengths, and then went on to win her next race start at Sandown by about 5 lengths as well, I think. So she's a really classy filly. So I felt better when I saw her second race, getting beaten so solidly by her. She started at 1,200 metres and she didn't quite finish it out. She seemed to run out of puff. And she's also very raw and very green. She's a big frame. In the parade ring, she still looked quite light on, so I think she's still maturing, and I think mentally also she's probably still maturing, but really promising. Third at her first start, and then she had a fifth at Hamilton, then stepped her up to 1400 meters, and again she just didn't quite finish, she didn't have enough puff for the 1400. She ran wide. Apparently her winkers came off the side and were flapping in the wind. And yeah, I think what we're seeing now is it's good, but I think with a bit of time and a bit more maturity and a bit more fitness and the right distance, I'm excited to see, yeah, where she goes.
Well, for those of you at home, the filly's name is now called Rolling In It. And I don't think we mentioned this before, but she was knocked down to Barry Griffiths, who is obviously an exceptional judge. So that should give us all a little bit of confidence that she'll be, a champion. And maybe not. Well, we might be going the early crow, but, you know, a very successful racehorse in the future.
Yeah, fingers crossed. Yeah, she's a lucky girl. She got a bit of a life upgrade. So she went from our little property, our little farm, to Barry Griffiths, which I think is probably quite a spectacular property. And she's getting all the time and all the care, I think, in the world. And she'll get all the opportunity, hopefully. So, yeah, we were very happy when she was sold to such a good home and was going to be given every opportunity.
Yes, definitely. Well, Kira, thank you so much for your time this morning, and I look forward to seeing how your pursuits go in the future.
Thanks, Charmaine. It's been great being on.
Well, we hope you enjoyed this episode, and if you see Tim and I around, come say hi.